Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Well, hey folks, and welcome to Solar Cabin Channel. I've got a neat little project for you. I call the Multi Shack. This is one of my homeless housing solutions designs. And some of you probably don't know this, but I was homeless twice in my life. The first time was when I was trying to get into college, and I had lost my job and was waiting for my college funding to come in. And so I had to live in my truck. I lived in the cab of my truck for almost 2 months while I waited for my college funding to come in. And then again later in life when I got divorced and didn't have a job and was trying to get off grid, I lived for almost 2 years in a camp trailer. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, homeless people that have their pride. They want to maintain their independence. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be caught up in the system. And, you know, all they need is a simple shelter. You know, some place to get out of the cold, to get out of the wind, to get out of the rain, while they get back on their feet. And so I know there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping the homeless, churches, nonprofits, and things like that. So I came up with this small structure design, which I call the multi-shack, because it has actually multi-uses to it. And it can be built very affordably. You can build this entire shack for under $200. And it is built on wheels. It can be put on either a 4x6 trailer, or you can build it on casters. Casters are a lot less expensive, but it still allows you to move this unit around. So you could store, you know, a bunch of these on a church parking lot, and then just when you need them, you can move them out to wherever you want the person to be using them. Casters are 4-inch casters. Each caster will hold up to 240 pounds, so they'll more than handle the weight for this structure here. Now, this structure is 6 foot 5 inches from the peak to the bottom, 6 foot 5 inches. So, and even a tall person can stand upright inside this structure. The door is 1 foot 6 inches wide and about 5 foot 3 inches to the peak up there in the door. And the structure is 4 foot wide, approximately, and about 6 foot long. About 6 foot long by 4 foot wide, 6 foot five to the peak. And this is constructed very inexpensively from 2x4 framing, which I'll show you, and uses, I would use 7/16 OSB or plywood. Either one would work for the siding on this. Now, a couple of the features here. I show this with dorm windows. The dorm windows are actually optional. You don't have to put dorm windows. You can just go with a flat roof surface if you want here. I show this with wood shingles, or you could use just plain old tar paper and roofing shingles. Any type of roofing shingles would work on this. Show it with a little flower box there just for effect. And on the backs and the front, I show this with these round windows, like boat-style windows, or you could put square windows. Either one works. I just like the effect of the round windows, the look of those in there. This does have an access panel on the back. Down here is an access panel. We'll just open this up so I can show you. Open up, take this one off. There we go. Now you can see inside the access panel. Underneath the seat and bed is storage, lots of storage underneath here for a propane tank, one of those Port-a-Loo porta potties, an ice chest over there you can see. Okay, so there's good storage. This is about 18 inches high inside here and about 4 feet wide inside. So the structure, I'll show this with the door open. Let me just hide this door here. With the door open, you can see I've got this set up. Right now I've got it set up for seating. During the day, this would be used for seating purposes, okay? And I'm going to pull the side roof off here so I can show you inside. But this has a very nice space for a person that maybe is going to school or working, or just the table can be used for eating or whatever. So you've got approximately 6 feet of space on the inside here by 4 feet wide. And this table is actually part of the bed platform, which I'll show you. You just pull the 2x4 out, put it in one of these slots. It's in this 2x4 here. There's another one on the other side. You just drop the 2x4 into the slot, and then you take your bed panel and put it up on top of that, and then that becomes a table. Here you've got 2 foot by 4 foot cushions. There's three of these cushions that become your bed, or you can use a roll-up mattress pad underneath this that becomes your bed. But during the daytime, it becomes seating. It becomes a little mini couch in here, 4 foot wide. And now you've got a space for a student to do their studies, their work, or for having your meal, or if you're working on a hobby or a craft or something like that, you've got this nice little space. When you get out the door, you just lift the table up, put it back, put the 2x4 back in the bottom slots, put the table down, and then you turn it into a bed. And I'm going to show you what it looks like as a bed, too. So, good headroom in this. I really like that it's got a very good space. This is an average person, 5'8" tall. You can see you've got lots of headroom here. You've got these nice dormer windows, which would give you lots of light, and also gives you a little bit more headroom up in this area right in here. A 6 foot person could stand up in the middle of this quite comfortably. Two people could actually sit side by side on this couch, or you can pull your ice chest cooler out, or someone could put a foldable chair on the other side here. So you could actually have two people sitting side by side or crossways next to each other here. So lots of space in this little place. So let me show you what the framing looks like on this first. And I'll just have to zoom in on this. Now this is all done with 2x4 construction to keep it inexpensive and easy to build. And then I would sheathe it with either 7/16 inch OSB or plywood. Either one would work. Now, it's got a floor frame, as you can see, made of 2x4s down here. Simple 2x4 frame, floor frame construction. And then your casters attached to the corners, not exactly in the corners, but they attach to the floor framing. And the casters have locks on them, so once you move this in place, you can just click on the locks and lock it in place so it won't be rolled around while the person is inside it. Now, this is the bed platform, and it has this back platform is 2 foot 6 inches wide, and it is permanently connected. These are 1 foot 9 inch wide platforms that can be raised up, and as you can see, these 2x4s right here, you put the 2x4 up in these other slots, and then you put these panels up on top, and they become either a table or workspace. This one can go up here. This one can go on the end. It can go over the middle. So I gave you lots of options for the ways that you can organize this into workspace or living space as you need to use it. Very simple construction. Takes about 20 2x4s to build this. That's about it. And you're looking at about under $200 for all the material costs. And you could build one of these in a day. Seriously, you could build the complete unit in about a day. And now I'm going to show you on the inside how this can be used as a bed and also as a small business. So I'm just going to click off this. Okay, now I show this with the bed down. The door open so you can kind of get a peek inside here. Now, this is an uninsulated structure. You really don't need insulation in a small structure like this because the human body puts off about as much heat as a 90-watt light bulb. So in a small structure like this, your own body heat will actually heat it up. And for sleeping, you can either do these pads like this as mattress pads, or you can just get a sleeping bag pad or even an air cushion pad to go underneath it. A sleeping bag pad would work fine because you can roll it up and use it as your seating. And a good heavy-duty sleeping bag would be all you would need in order to sleep very comfortably in here. As long as you don't have the wind blowing on you or the rain drenching you or snow piling up on you, you'll sleep very comfortably in a small structure like this. Your own body heat will heat it up. You could add a heater to these, but it really isn't necessary in these small structures. So I'm going to pull off the side roof, and I'm going to show you how much space this has inside it for a bed. It actually has a very nice bed that will sleep either one or two people. Pull this off here. Just hide this. Now, this has a 4 foot wide by 6 foot long bed. So even an average person can sleep in here. Even a tall person, fairly tall person, could sleep in here comfortably without being cramped. And it's 4 foot wide, so that's a very wide bed that will actually sleep two people. Two people could sleep in this space, all right? And it's 6 foot wide, and it's 4 foot wide and 6 foot long. This person I show in here is about 5 foot 8 inches tall, which is average height for most people. And here you can see the slots I was talking about. These platforms, which I'll show you, I'll take the bed off now. These two platforms are removable with 2x4s underneath them. You just take the 2x4, you put it in the slots that go across here, and then put these platforms up on top to make your table. And you can actually do a table on either end, or one in the middle for a desk and table. Now, the ones on the ends I'll show you are used if you want to run a small business out of here, or if you want to organize this in a different way so that if you're cooking, you could put one of these tables on this end or on this end, and you could set up your cooking supplies and you can take care of yourself. You can cook a meal inside this little place right here. So 4 foot wide, 6 foot long bed, and then very adaptable with these platforms of 2x4s. You can just put them up and you can reorganize this any way you want during the daytime for whatever function that you're going to be using. Again, it has storage space underneath the bed and seating. You've got that nice access panel for you. You've got storage underneath there. And I really like the space in here. This would be enough adequate space if in an emergency, let's say that a city has a disaster, a fire like they just had in Canada wipes out all these homes, or you have a tornado tear through a place, or you have flooding or something like that, which we've all seen in the news, happens all the time, and suddenly churches are overrun with people that don't have housing. You know, if you had a bunch of these sitting around that would sleep at least two people, you could pull these out in a small area. You could set these up and people would at least have shelter for, you know, survival until they can get into houses bigger shelters or something like that. So that's another use for this type of structure here. So now I'm going to put the bed back on just to show you. And And again, you can see this has really nice dormer windows. So you got really good light in this. And it's got an excellent sleeping space. For it would be better for one person, but it would be adequate for two people. Okay? And, you know, if you got little teeny kids with you, you could put, you know, one adult and a couple of kids in there, too. You know, there's enough space in there to sleep comfortably, and you've got lots and lots of headroom. You're not going to bump your head or anything while you're sleeping. Doorway, 1 foot 6 inches wide, 5 foot 3 inches to the top up here. So lots and lots of good space in this. Now I'm going to show you how this can also be modified to be used as a small business. Okay, one thing I know about people that are homeless is they're also very creative, and you know, a lot of them actually run little businesses in order to support themselves. A lot of them do recycling. They recycle cans and bottles and other stuff like that, or they pick up small appliances and stuff that they may find on the streets, or books or pictures or whatever, and they resell them, and that's how they support themselves. A lot of them are also very crafty people. They may make jewelry, or they may make wood crafts or something like that, or they may be artists. And so they have a way to support themselves, and so I think we ought to encourage that, because that helps them to develop sustainability. Not everybody is equipped to work in the regular workforce. Some people just aren't, but they're very industrious and can support themselves with a small business. And so I thought, well, this shack could also be used for setting up a small business. So what I did is I made this so that the window here can be hinged up, and I'll show this. The window on one of the dormers, or both, can be hinged up out of the way. And then you've got room here to put a sales counter or little platform here where this person is 5 foot 8 inches tall. A person can stand in this window and they can operate a small business. They can talk to customers, they can take money, whatever, working right out of this small shack. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be for homeless people. If you wanted to run a hot dog or hamburger stand, or sell your crafts or your books, or, you know, whatever you want to do with this, maybe it's a ticket stand, I don't know. This little shack could be very useful for a lot of different purposes. That's why I call it a multi-shack, is because it can be used for many different purposes. But this would be great for a homeless person that has a craft that they make, or recycle products or whatever. They want to sell them, they just hinge up the window, and they set themselves up a little business here to take care of customers. Now, this also shows inside how those tables can be reorganized. Here you can see I've lifted up the bed platform to put a table on this end, another table on this end, and you can use this for cooking in here. You can see I've got a little two-burner propane stove that you can set up on one of the tables up there, so you can do your cooking. You can work on your crafts. This table just lifts off, a 2x4 lifts off if you need to get access to the door. Lots of good headroom, okay? Workspace in there. This can be modified many different ways for many different people of however you want to use it. So a very functional space in there. All right, so that is the multi-shack, all right? And let me just unhide this so you can get a better view of it. Again, can be built very inexpensively. Around under $200 on casters, more expensive if you put it on a trailer. And I'm going to provide these plans for free because this is a project that I designed specifically for churches and nonprofit organizations to build shelters. And at present in the U.S., we have about 1.6 million homeless people that just need a simple shelter to live in. Or that's about one out of 200 people. And that's just in the U.S. There's a lot of people in other countries that are in even worse shape. And I really think a project like this would be great for helping the homeless people to have shelter while maintaining their independence and their pride. But it could also be used as disaster relief shelters. You know, we could easily have a major disaster in a city where we have thousands and thousands of people that suddenly are homeless, and we need to provide quick shelter. These would also work for that. It would be big enough space for two people to sleep and, you know, to take care of their basic needs. And that's what this structure is about. So I hope you like this design. It's called the Multi-Shack. You can get the plans for free on my website, SimpleSolarHomesteading.com. Up at the top, look at Multi-Shack. Now, there is a button there. If you would like to donate, your donations are used by me to design structures like this and build small houses. I work with a lot of homeless people that don't want to be in the system, that want to build their own off-grid cabins and houses and places like that. I help them with designs and building those projects. So any donation, if you can donate, is very appreciated and will help with those projects. All right, folks, I hope you like this project called the Multi-Shack, and have a great day.
Hi, my name is Luke, and this video will be like a tour of my house. Before the tour starts, I want to talk a little bit about myself. I'm 13 years old, and when I started this build, I was 12 years old. It's been a little over a year and a half, probably a little less than that since I started this build. It is 10 feet long, 5.5 feet wide. The tallest point of the house is 10 feet tall, the lowest point is 8 feet tall, and it is a total of 89 square feet. The main reason I wanted to build a tiny house was I wanted something to do during the summer. I was getting really bored during the summer, and I got really fascinated with tiny houses, watching YouTube videos and stuff like that. So I decided that if I worked towards it and made enough money from cutting lawns, that I would start to build a tiny house. I learned a lot of it. I learned a lot, like framing, wiring, simple framing techniques, a lot of different skills I learned along the way, carpeting, stuff like that. Also, a lot of woodworking skills, how to use saws, drills, impacts, like multiple tools, and stuff like that. When I was growing up, I used a lot of tools, like a drill, impact, saws. I was really familiar with because my dad had always used them, and I would be exposed to the tools at a young age. So I knew how to use tools quite regularly, and it wasn't very much of a learning curve. Framing the house was a learning curve for me. My dad did a few remodeling projects and stuff like that, so he knew how to do it, but framing, I had no clue how to do it. Now that I'm done building, I think it's a very simple process, but when I started, I didn't know what to do. I started a YouTube channel probably halfway through the build, and I started to document my process. I wish I would have started it the day I started, but that's just not the way it worked out. But I hope to be building another tiny house here in a couple years that I'll be actually living in full time, and it'll be an actual, like a lot bigger size tiny house than this one is. So I kind of made this tiny house as the learning tiny house. So I learned a lot of skills, and by building this tiny house, and I want to take those skills from this house and move them on to a bigger tiny home. So the number one way I made money was by mowing lawns. I also did lots of bartering. So my dad's friend lives up the street from me, and he's an electrician. And I cleaned his garage out so his new car can go in his garage. And he helped pay and helped show me how to wire the house. So he helped me with the whole wiring process. And so it's professionally wired. Another thing I did was I cut one of the adults that I knew from Scouts. I cut his lawn for his apartment buildings. He helped me put carpet in my loft. So he is a carpenter, and he lays carpet and stuff like that. But he helped me with that part of the build. A lot of people donated through a GoFundMe page, and that was a big help. But most of it was paid by myself, and my parents did not help me pay for it. But my parents did help me with a lot of things, like build. Some big things that happened during the build is I was featured on the front page of the Telegraph Herald. One of my school teachers saw my YouTube channels, and he asked if I wanted to keep it small or I wanted everyone to know about it. And so I think he knew someone that worked in the TH, and he let them know about what I was doing. And they picked it up, and they wrote a whole story about me. A couple days later, they came to my school. They interviewed me. That day they came to my house, took photos, and that morning it was in the paper. So it was a very quick process and stuff like that. Also, I've gotten lots of emails from TV producers and stuff like that. Some want to start teen tiny house shows. And also, I've been invited to speak at tiny house festivals. So lots of things are happening just from me building the tiny house and stuff like that. And it's really cool that the city that I live in, a lot of people know me just from the paper and stuff like that. And they've also came and looked at the house. I hope to be holding a tiny house, open house, this month. And I hope that goes well because I want to invite everyone that donated and helped me through the build. I'm not full-time living in the house, but I do spend a couple nights every other week sleeping in it. I do spend a lot of time in it. I kind of call it my homework center, you know. It is summer break right now, but when I do get homework, and I have done homework in here, and it's really nice. I also have a twin brother, so it helps that I have my own space. So my total cost, I'm finally done with the build, and the total cost of this build is, I'm rounding it up to $1,500. It's more like $1,200, but just to round up in case I forgot anything, I rounded it up to $1,500. Me and my dad really bonded through the process. Me and him spent nights and days building it, and he really helped me. At the time, he was working a full-time job, and he had college to deal with, so he was really busy, but he made sure to spend time with me and coach me through the process of building a house. And I'm really grateful for a good dad, mom, and a good family. So now I think it's time. I've done enough talking, and I think it's time for you guys to see the tour. Hope you guys enjoy. We're now on the outside of the house. My house has the front wall and the side wall are cedar shaped. I didn't really do a pattern with them. I just kind of threw them up there. So on the outside, there's a deck. I built this deck. It's fully reclaimed. I spent zero money on it. If you go on this side over here, I have some landscaping right here. These are two peony bushes. And then one of my subscribers thought I should have a flag on the outside of my house, so now I have a flag on the outside of my house. This is a spruce tree, I think, that is not growing, partially my fault. And then we have another flower right here. This is where the electricity comes into my house. There's kind of one that runs all the way back there. This is one of my side windows. I reclaimed this window. And on the back side of the house, I just have some more flowers, and we have the back and this side wall over here is covered with vinyl. This is fully reclaimed vinyl siding from my grandma's house that she had left over. On the front of the house, we have a steel door. This I got reclaimed. One of my uncle's friend had this, and so I painted it, and it's a steel door with the window. I have another window that's reclaimed for free, and I spent $35 on that window right there. I have around a 4 foot, not even a 4 foot, overhang, so I can, you know, unlock the door when it's raining, and I don't have to worry about rain getting on me. I have some flowers over here, and then I have a tomato plant that's growing some tomatoes right now. I built a mini fireplace right here, and then I have a hammock stand on the opposite side. Now that we're done with the outside tour, there's not much on the outside, but there's a lot inside, so let's make our ways inside. So right as you walk in to the house, we have a carpet that kind of, you know, makes it feel a little more homey. The floor is actually plywood that I used some putty, leveled it out, and then painted it. That was just because it's not air conditioning in here, and if you ever, you know, because there's not air conditioning, heat and cold, and the floor would just not look good. So I decided to paint the floor, and it also made it cost less. Right as you walk into your right side, you have the kitchen. This is the kitchen countertop. There's a big story on this. I'll have to watch my kitchen countertop fail. But I also have storage right underneath it where I keep some, you know, news articles and stuff like that. Right above it, we have the countertop right here. This is a medicine cabinet, which I store some things like, you know, cups, lighter, flashlight, some silverware, you know, seasoning, stuff like that. The tiling right here is actually sticky floor tile that I used, and it looks really nice. Above here, we have some storage.
It was almost 2 years ago that I started work on a small log cabin in the northern Canadian bush. And it has been exactly a year since I closed the cabin door for the last time and moved away. Finally, I got the chance to return, and I am anxious to see how the cabin has fared the last 4 seasons on its own. While most parts of North America are enjoying mild spring weather with no snow, my aluminum snowshoes are falling through waist-deep powder and temperatures of minus 20 degrees Celsius. Although this looks like January weather, would you believe that this is late April? It's been a long, hard winter here. Lots of snow and a solid month of minus 40 degree temperatures. There were even a few days that registered right around minus 50. It seems that the lynx population has been hit the hardest this winter. Several locals have reported that their dogs have been attacked by lynx along the hiking trails. Normally, lynx avoid this sort of contact with bigger dogs and humans, but the prolonged cold temperatures have forced them to make desperate decisions. It wasn't far from here that I spotted a mother lynx and her two cubs last year. And of course, I didn't have my camera ready at the time. On my way into the cabin, yet another lynx had silently stalked behind me for a short distance, but it eventually turned off my path and took a different direction. And I wouldn't have noticed it at all if it weren't for the footprints it left behind over my fresh tracks. In building the cabin, I wanted it to be simple for 2 reasons. Number one, because of the cabin's location, I knew that I'd be having to do everything by hand. Getting the equipment and supplies in, moving and hoisting the logs would all have to be done with good old-fashioned manpower. And reason number two, I didn't have a lot of money to work with, simple as that. And in this complicated world, simple just seems to offer more. Complicated offers bells and whistles, but simple. Simple offers freedom. Although some would argue that this cabin wasn't built to code, it is still perfectly legal. That's because it's built on privately owned property, and the local government doesn't require a permit for any structure that is 10 feet by 10 feet or under. And this log cabin just so happens to be exactly 10 feet by 10 feet. So yes, I'm aware that building my logs right on the ground without proper footings and not debarking them means that they will not last a whole century, like they could have if I had done all these things. But that's just fine. These logs will probably last at least a quarter century without any need for repairs. And so far, the cabin has settled and dried out quite nicely, and the bottom rows don't show any signs of rotting in the near future. I am also aware that I'm using a tarp to cover the roof. And contrary to popular belief, it is not instantly disintegrated or even began to fade yet. Besides, tarps can be replaced easily enough and at low cost, so even if I have to replace it every 5 to 10 years or so, it won't be a problem.
I'll just make sure to buy the heavy-duty kind. And yes, I know that there are gaps in my door, and that it most definitely isn't bear-proof, but in the wintertime, when there's a draft, I just place a blanket over the door and it stays quite warm and cozy inside. As for the bears, I haven't had any try to come inside yet, and if they do, they're not going to find it too terribly interesting. There's no food, and I didn't leave any fine china behind for Mr. Bear to break. Anyway, I like the door, and so it stays, gaps and all. Did I mention that it used to be a coffee table? My point is, there will always be some who will find fault in this simple design, but all I know is that it works for me. And at the end of it all, I only spent about $500 on the entire cabin, and most of that money went into the lumber I used in the roof. If I wasn't planning on moving at the time, I would have taken longer to construct the roof out of smaller logs, which would have significantly brought down the cost that much more. But I don't regret a single decision I made in the cabin's construction. Upon entering the cabin, I could see signs that there had been a visitor in my absence. A couple wads of insulation along the top logs and a pile of pine nuts on the shelf told me that a squirrel had stopped by for a visit at some point. Oh well, no harm done. It wasn't anything that 15 minutes of dusting couldn't fix. When I stepped back outside, I was surprised to see an old friend. Meet Charles. When I first started building the cabin, Charles would always fly past between 10:30 and 11:30 a.m. every morning. He always flew toward the west, and he was always 100 meters to the south of me. It was his morning routine. After a while, instead of simply flying past, Charles would break from his scheduled flight plan to circle overhead a few times. I figured it was his way of saying hello. Eventually, when Charles came overhead my little clearing in the bush, he would stop to land on a nearby tree to watch as I worked, and in this way we kept each other company. It was then that I named him Charles, and this is how our relationship continued until I moved away. Every day he'd come to visit between 10:30 and 11 a.m. He would call and I would call back at him. And so you can imagine how happy I was to see him again over a year later. He perched on a nearby tree when I arrived, and so I'd like to think that he recognized me. It's always good seeing an old friend, even if he is an old crow. So what started me on this simple cabin project? Well, I'm a youth pastor, and my church owns some bush property. And so I figured building a log cabin on the property would be a great project for my youth group to work together on. And although I worked alone most of the time, the youth would get together and join me on a Saturday from time to time, or for a couple hours after school. It was a great opportunity for them to learn new skills, make friends, and gain confidence in themselves. On other occasions, a friend would join me for an afternoon to help out. Sometimes there were people who I barely knew that wanted to lend a hand. So, if nothing else, I made a lot of good friends during the construction of this cabin. And so, when the cabin was complete, I donated it to the church and the youth group.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call,
Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury.
Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism.
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down, and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have cut rate insurance, it may not pay for all this. You get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate agent.
The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers.
Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line